From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start in Washington, where today the House Judiciary Committee voted along party lines to subpoena the full Mueller report. Republicans opposed to the subpoena included the ranking Republican Doug Collins of Georgia.
It reminds me of the old guys back in my hometown when they wanted to go fishing and nothing was biting. And one day this old guy just got tired of it. Instead of catching anything the way he should, he just reaches in his back pocket, pulls out a piece of dynamite, and throws it in the pond. I can't find anything, so I'm just going to blow up everything, and maybe something will come to the top.
Let's bring in NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, that was colorful. But give us some context here. Attorney General Barr has said he would deliver the report mid-April, but with parts redacted. Now, yesterday, I think it was five Democratic committee chairs wrote a letter saying they wanted an unredacted version to fulfill Congress's role to hold the president accountable. Is that what this committee vote is asking for in its subpoena?
Well, the committee vote was along party lines, Democrats voting to release it and Republicans not. And this is really Congress just flexing its muscles, House Democrats reminding Republicans that they're there and that they're in charge. You know, like you said, Barr said that he would release the report mid-April. I think what Democrats really would want and prefer is maybe if the full report was not released to the public, because obviously they believe there need to be some redactions when it comes to grand jury deliberations, when it comes to protecting private citizens who were eventually not pursued with crimes, that they believe Congress should at least have that full report because they need to be able to do their oversight duties.
Yeah, well, they also authorized subpoenas for figures in Trump's orbit, including former White House counsel Don Mann, his former chief of staff Ann Donaldson, former advisor Steve Bannon, former spokesperson Hope Hicks, former chief of staff Reince Priebus. I mean, what's the expectation here?
Well, you know, they could probably delay as long as they like, but this is putting some pressure on them. And if they do delay and don't cooperate, then they could be held in contempt by Congress. And but that could take a while, could go on some time, and you could have the Trump administration claim executive privilege and wind up having that end up in the courts.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we've wanted to ask you, whatever happened to health care? And last night, the president spoke at the National Republican Congressional Committee's annual spring dinner. Last week, he called for ending Obamacare, then pivoted from that, calling for shutting down the border, ending aid to Central American countries. But here he is last night on health care.
So essentially what I'm saying is we're going to come up with a health care plan. We're not going to vote on it until after the election. We'll all promise it's going to be our first vote. Because we blew it the last time. Man, I was fed a bill of goods. I want to tell you, some of you, I'm still a little bit angry, but not all of you.
Okay, there's that. But then this morning, the president tweeted, I was never planning a vote prior to the 2020 election on the wonderful health care package that some very talented people are now developing for me and the Republican Party. It goes on. But that's not true, is it? That he was never, I mean, wasn't he asking Mitch McConnell for that?
Well, look, Republicans had, essentially lost on health care in the 2018 presidential election. And this was not an issue that Republican leadership or Republican rank and file wanted to get back into again. This is not a winning issue for Republicans. It hasn't been. They haven't been able to get right on this subject to be able to come forward with a plan that they could coalesce around to say that they could replace Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act with. So being able to delay this past the election is something that Republican leadership wanted done because President Trump did start talking about wanting to have something done before the election. Mm-hmm. And I think that this will automatically now make health care a principal issue for the 2020 election.
Right. And it seems as if he was talked down off that potential ledge. But just we want to ask you in the minute we have, President Trump yesterday said again, as he has in the past, that his father was born in Germany. He said it several times. Born in Germany, great country. His father was born in the Bronx. Should people be alarmed about this? I mean, what's going on here?
His father was the son of German immigrants. His grandfather, Donald Trump's grandfather, Friedrich, was born in Germany, emigrated to the United States, tried to go back to Germany, and actually was not allowed to go back to Germany because he failed to perform mandatory military service. So obviously Trump has some roots in Germany with his grandfather, Friedrich, but his father was not born in Germany.
Domenico Montanaro, NPR's lead political editor. Thank you as always.
You're so welcome.
Well, Alabama is the latest state where lawmakers are trying to ignite a new legal challenge to Roe versus Wade, the 1973 Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion. Here's Republican State Representative Terry Collins, who introduced a bill yesterday that would make it a felony for a doctor to perform an abortion in Alabama.
I think we have a lot more technology now that shows the continuing life of that baby from early on until birth. I know sonograms we have now. All those weren't available in 1973. And so it's definitely time for the courts to relook at this.
This comes on the heels of several so-called heartbeat bills. One passed through Georgia's state legislature. Others have been signed into law by the governors of Mississippi and Kentucky. So a lot going on in the legal challenges to abortion rights. But will any of it hold up in court? Joining us now is Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's first talk about that bill introduced yesterday in Alabama. It criminalizes all abortions except in cases where the mother's life is threatened. And its sponsor says it is specifically designed to challenge Roe v. Wade. Where does it stand?
Well, it's funny. We've seen these over the years since 1973. We keep having sort of spurts of them every time abortion opponents think they might have a chance at getting something through the Supreme Court. Except I think for the first time, at least since I've been covering this, they might have a chance of getting something through the Supreme Court. They do now appear to have five votes with Justice Kennedy, now retired. He'd been the swing vote on this for quite a long time.
So as we said, there's the Alabama law, but then there are the heartbeat bills that are being moved through in several states. This would make abortion illegal once doctors can detect a fetus's heartbeat. How much would a law like that change the legality of abortion?
Oh, it would change it an enormous amount. Actually, one of the things that doctors say about these heartbeat bills, first of all, even 6 weeks is before many women know that they're pregnant. So in some ways, it would simply ban abortion, much like the Alabama bill, which doesn't pretend that it's not trying to ban abortion entirely. But the other thing about the heartbeat bills is that there are doctors who are concerned that it would make doctors wary of treating pregnancy complications. If something were to happen to the baby, suddenly they would be liable legally for having, quote unquote, performed an abortion, even when that was not their intent. So these heartbeat bills and the total bans that we're seeing are all aimed at getting to the Supreme Court and getting the court to overrule or severely modify, roll back the rights that were in Roe v. Wade and the cases that followed it.
Well, the heartbeat bill in Kentucky was already blocked by a district court within hours of being signed into law. On what grounds was that blocked?
Well, all of these bills are likely to be blocked because current Supreme Court precedent says you can't do this. So the only way these would happen is if they were to go through the entire legal process and have the Supreme Court say, yeah, we've changed our minds. We think that maybe this is okay now, even though we haven't thought this was okay because we didn't have the votes for the last 40-some years.
One of the states we're going to be watching in the coming days is Georgia, where Governor Brian Kemp expressed support for a heartbeat bill that passed through his state's legislature last Friday. Here he is.
Georgia is a state that values life. We shield the vulnerable and shelter the innocent. Let's champion life today and ensure that all Georgians, including the unborn, have the chance to live, grow, and prosper.
Now, Kemp is expected to sign that bill into law any day now. Legal challenges are expected. Does it stand a chance?
Well, it's in the same boat as all the rest of them. You've got a lot of these states where you have, you know, the conservative lawmakers, they want to be the state that gets its law to the Supreme Court and overturns or significantly modifies Roe v. Wade. So there's something of a race going on. But they're all basically, as I mentioned, lower courts would basically have to at least stay them until and unless the Supreme Court were to change its mind, because current precedent says you can't ban abortion this early in pregnancy.
So when will this get to the Supreme Court, do you think?
Well, that's a good question. So it depends on how fast the lower courts process these cases and the appeals courts process these cases. I would not expect to see one of these cases get to the Supreme Court for another, you know, year or so. There are some other abortion cases in the pipeline, though, that could get there sooner.
And if it does get to the Supreme Court, or I guess when these cases do get to the Supreme Court, now that we've got Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch on the court, two appointees from President Trump, could a challenge like the ones we're seeing be successful?
Yes. I think that's the big hope among anti-abortion advocates and the big fear among people who support abortion rights is that we could see a significant rollback of abortion rights, perhaps not a complete overturn of Roe v. Wade, but there's every expectation that probably one of these laws is going to pass muster with the current Supreme Court.
Even though I remember the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and Susan Collins, one of the senators that ended up voting for Kavanaugh, said that she was assured that he thought that Roe v. Wade was settled law.
We've heard that before from a lot of nominees to the Supreme Court who have then voted the other way once they're on the court, including a couple who are sitting there now, like Justice Alito.
That is Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Julie, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Twenty years ago this month, everything changed. Columbine, a high school in Colorado, was under attack by two students. Some might not be able to listen now to what the country was hearing then as the siege was broadcast live for hours, first responders helpless outside because the protocol then was to wait for a SWAT team, as calls poured into 911, like this one from a teacher in the library bloodied by broken glass, begging kids to get down.
And the school is in a panic, and I'm in the library. I've got students down under the table, kids! Heads under the table!
Columbine wasn't the first shooting in the U.S., but it was the worst at the time. 13, including Coach Dave Sanders, would die, 10 in that library. Over 20 were wounded. Protocols were changed. Now first responders are told, get in as fast as you can. But as we heard yesterday from Frank DeAngelis, those who survived that day, like that teacher in the library, can still be emotionally devastated 20 years on. Frank's new memoir, his first, is called They Called Me Mr. D. He'd been a teacher at Columbine since 1979, then the beloved principal, who'd be rolled into an assembly playing a piano, singing like Barry Manilow. He now travels the country trying to help other schools after shootings. He knew the parent from Sandy Hook who recently killed himself and worries about who's next. We'll have yesterday's conversation with Principal Frank DeAngelis at hereandnow.org. A warning, today's will also be tender, maybe triggers for some. We began with April 20th, 1999. Do you mind if we go back to that day?
No, that's okay. Fine.
Well, you usually covered the lunch period to be closer to the kids, but you were in your office, and then at 11:19, the shots rang out. You run towards them.
And the first thing that crossed my mind is this has to be a senior prank. This cannot be happening. And my worst nightmare became a reality because I encountered the gunman. Everything just kind of slowed down, not sure what I was going to do. What was it going to feel like to have bullets pierce my body? Now, through counseling, through some type of techniques, I learned why I continued to go towards that gunman, because I had about 25 girls that were coming out of the locker room to go to a physical education class.
Well, you were able to herd those 20 or so girls toward a storage closet and incredibly pull the right key out to open the door. I mean, one more, you know, just a couple more seconds and you all could have been shot.
And that key story, because it was a key of 35, it was in the middle of these keys. And if I wasn't able to find that key on the first try, who knows, I probably would not be doing this interview. But the thing that adds to the survivor's guilt is I found out later through police reports that Dave Sanders, again, he was my mentor. If he would have stayed in the faculty lounge, I would have died that day because what happened is he ran up the staircase, and as he's running down to warn kids, the gunman was coming towards me, and he catches glimpse of Dave, so he stops momentarily to turn around, and unfortunately, he shoots Dave through the back of the head, and that moment that caused the gunman to slow down as he was coming towards me and the girls probably saved our lives.
What's happening to you when you're telling me this?
You know, right now, I have some butterflies. When I tell the key story, I get chills, and I think of those girls, you know, screaming. I hear the gunshots. I remember that door pulling on it. But then what I have to do, and I learned this through my counselor, is I have to replay the things differently. You know, I have to think back to Dave Sanders and the time we spent together teaching and coaching. And these girls, they send me pictures now of their daughters or sons, and they said, Mr. D, I am so grateful you found that key. If not, I wouldn't have this beautiful family.
Well, then it continues. You have to start the school up again. You know, you're learning as you go, and you realize you can't serve Chinese food because it was what kids were eating in the cafeteria when the shooting started. You can't show war videos.
I mean, the first time we did fire drill, I had to change that sound because many of the kids and staff members were trapped in the building for over 3 hours.
Right.
Students could not wear camouflage because some of the law enforcement that came in to free up the kids were wearing camouflage. These are things we were never ready for. And I had the first dose of post-traumatic stress disorder, what it was like when our parents decided to put up an archway of balloons when we returned to go to school. We didn't think anything of it until the balloons started popping. And all of a sudden, you see these kids diving on the ground. And that's when I said, oh, my gosh, it's going to be a tough road ahead.
Yeah, and it was.
There's a couple of things that really have improved greatly. We have proven that locked classroom doors are a key to protecting students and staff. These perpetrators realize that the event is going to be over within 10 minutes because of the change in protocol. There's going to be responding officers. So if they come onto a classroom and that door is locked, they're going to move on to what they consider a soft target. One of the other things that Colorado, we're so fortunate, we have a program called Safe to Tell, and it's a 24/7 anonymous tip line. At Parkland, you know, the killer was broadcasting what he was going to do. And so that 24/7 hotline is outstanding. And, you know, people say, well, Frank, we continue to hear about these shootings. But how many have been stopped because of things we have in place today that we didn't have in place back in 1999?
Well, one hopes more can be stopped. But what about guns? You're against a large ban, but you'd like to see some restrictions. The ease with which the two shooters were able to get guns it's nauseating. They had a friend, 18. She went to a gun show with them. You know, they said, wait, you're 18. We can't do this because we're not old enough. So she bought them the guns. She said later she didn't have to fill out anything. There was no background check. There was not even a receipt. First of all, I can't imagine what her life is like, knowing that she provided guns. But how was she able to do that? Shouldn't that be changed?
And that's the question I get asked, especially last year after Parkland, politicians coming out and saying, if we have tougher gun laws, there is never going to be another school shooting. And that's where I disagree. Mm. I mean, loopholes, the young lady that you're speaking of, she said if they would have made it more difficult, because at the time, independent gun dealers did not have to do background checks. Well, since that time, there have been gun laws in place.
In Colorado, yes, but go ahead.
What I question is when people say that's the only thing that's allowing these to happen, because I think back to Columbine, the two gunmen, in addition to getting the guns from the young lady, they purchased some guns illegally that were used in the killing.
Sure. Young people went to prison for selling them.
Exactly.
To them. Yeah.
We also have to look at students that may be struggling. It saddens me when school districts are cutting back on mental health and then the role that social media is playing in these kids' lives. Now you take each piece of this puzzle, you put it together, and we have a chance of stopping these massacres from occurring.
Yeah. Frank DeAngelis, there's so much more. Oprah taped a show with you. You were very unhappy because it concentrated on the killers and you wanted to concentrate on the kids. And so she called you and said, I won't run it. Well, look at that. I mean, so many moments of grace and moments of horror. But you say every single day you recite their names?
Every morning. Cassie Bernal, Stephen Kernow, Corey DePooter, Kelly Fleming, Matt Kechter, Daniel Mauser, Danny Rohrbaugh, Rachel Scott, Isaiah Scholes, John Tomlin, Lauren Townsend, Kyle Velasquez, and Dave Sanders. Every morning I wake up, the first thing when I get out of bed is I recite, you know, my beloved 13. If I reached out to people, they could name the names of the two perpetrators, but they would have a hard time naming the names of the victims. And I made a promise that I'm never going to let those 13 die in vain.
I think we'll leave it at that. I don't know how you do it.
Well, I'm pretty emotional. I make the joke that I get emotional at the grand opening of a Walmart. And so, I mean, I cry when I present. Comes back. I share a story about Sean Graves. When Sean Graves was paralyzed, Sean Graves and Patrick Ireland and Anne-Marie Hall-Coulter and Richard Castaldo, they gave me hope. There was a chance that Sean would never walk again. I said, Sean, I'm looking so forward to when you graduate and me handing you your diploma. You know, he worked hard. He passed all of his classes, but he did not walk until that day. About 10,000 people there, and they announce his name. And all of a sudden, Sean puts his hand up, gets out of the wheelchair, and walks over to get his diploma. And he said, Mr. D, I'm here to get my diploma. Thanks for never giving up on me. Patrick Ireland, the boy in the window.
The boy in the window. He jumped out of the window, bloodied from the library, just to try to survive. He was, first responders were below him.
Yes, and he could not even put three words together to make a sentence. Less than 9 months later, he graduated number one in his class, valedictorian. In the class of 2002, he went on to CSU, graduating top 10%. The kid is just phenomenal, and I can remember he invited me to his wedding. Kenny Kosak, who is the director at Craig Hospital, tapped me on the shoulder. I turn around, he's crying, I'm crying, and he said, did you ever think that you would see Patrick Ireland walking down the aisle to marry that beautiful woman? You know, Patrick has two daughters and a son, and he's my financial advisor, and I am so happy Patrick's alive.
Yeah. That's Frank DeAngelis. His memoir is They Call Me Mr. D, the story of Columbine's heart, resilience, and recovery. Frank, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you. And when I have those conversations with, you know, Ty Thompson, the principal from Parkland, and Rachel Brindell from Santa Fe, I said, don't ever give up hope, because where we were 19 years ago, and I look to where we are right now, there is hope, so don't ever give up. And I said, I'm not going away. I'm going to be with you every step of the way.
A Chinese woman is facing federal charges after that mysterious security breach at President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach, Florida over the weekend. Yujing Zhang managed to make it past Secret Service agents at the entrance to Mar-a-Lago. Then it was a receptionist who turned her back to Secret Service because, while she originally said she was there for a swim and a United Nations friendship event, there was no event, and they later found out she didn't have a bathing suit. Joining us now is Nick Nahamas, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. And Nick, this woman's now in custody. Tell us about the technology that she had on her.
Well, she had a lot of electronic devices. She had four cell phones, one laptop, one external hard drive, and a thumb drive that was loaded or infected with what the Secret Service called malicious malware.
Well, and what are the concerns about that?
It's unclear if she was, say, a bumbling tourist who, you know, happened to have a device containing malware that had been inadvertently downloaded, something that has happened to all of us, or if there's something more sinister going on, if she was, in fact, intending to install some kind of electronic recording or monitoring device at the president's private resort.
And the president was not there at the time, we should say, but his family was, his wife was. And to the things this woman said she wanted to do, as we said she wanted to go for a swim but didn't have a bathing suit. She said she wanted to attend an event. This is where her story intersects with Cindy Lee Yang. She's the woman who once owned the massage parlor where Patriots owner Robert Kraft and others went and are now facing charges for soliciting prostitution and the salon itself accused with trafficking women. She did have an event scheduled for that night, but it was canceled?
Yes, she had, it looks like, two separate events scheduled for that night. And one of her business associates, a man named Charles Lee, runs a group called the United Nations China Friendship Association. And the woman who was arrested said she was there to attend a United Nations China Friendship event. So that's a connection with Cindy Yang. Cindy Yang had been advertising these events, and the woman showed up hoping to attend one.
Well, this is the kind of thing conspiracy theorists love. You know, what is the sense of these stories interconnecting, of the security of what's the second White House? You know, we remember when the president met with high-ranking officials in the dining room and waiters were holding iPhone lights so that these visiting officials could read sensitive documents in the middle of the dining room. There, you know, there has been concern. What are the concerns here?
Well, you know, the national security experts we've been interviewing have always talked about the security risks at Mar-a-Lago, which is private but can be accessed by citizens who have enough money to get in or know a member. These security concerns have been more theoretical. This is the first instance of potentially an actual security threat at the President's Club.
And so what happens now?
Ms. Jiang has a detention hearing on April 8th. Meanwhile, congressional Democrats several weeks ago called for a counterintelligence and campaign finance investigation into Ms. Yang. The Department of Justice and FBI have not answered their request yet. So now you have congressional Democrats upset that their request was not answered. And now there's a potential national security threat.
Nick Nahamas, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. We will follow this story with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's take a break from the news now for a special opera edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Mary Jo Heath is the host and announcer for the Metropolitan Opera. She joins us from New York. Welcome.
Hi, Jeremy. Nice to be with you.
It is great to have you with us. And how did you get into this, by the way, announcing the Metropolitan Opera?
Well, I've been in classical music for my whole life, basically. Played a lot of instruments, majored in music theory. And for about 9 years, I was the senior radio producer here. Before then, I've changed sides of the desk, and this is now my fourth season as the host.
Wonderful. Well, let's get to some of the pieces of music that you brought us today. The first one is La Bohème by Giacomo Puccini. Now, people that have seen the musical Rent already know the plot of La Bohème. Rent is based on La Bohème. Tell us a little bit about it for people that have not seen it.
Well, it's the story of bohemians, starving artists in Paris, living that kind of life. And during the course of the story, they all kind of grow up through some very tragic things that happen.
Okay, well, let's listen to a little bit. Now, since we are not at Lincoln Center and we don't have those little things in the back of the seats in front of us that translate the lyrics, to tell us what's going on here.
Well, this is kind of the end of Act Two of La Bohème, the act that takes place on the streets of Paris on a bustling Christmas Eve. All of our bohemians are out having a great time. And there's a little domestic drama going on at this moment. And this is the moment when Musetta falls back into the arms of her ex-boyfriend, Marcello. And she sings Marcello and he sings Sirena because she's his siren. Mm-hmm. So it's a little fun moment there. I love the ensembles in opera as much as I love the arias. And that's why I wanted to start with that one.
Okay. Well, the next one that you've brought us is by another Italian composer. This is Giuseppe Verdi. This is his take on Shakespeare's Otello. This is called Ave Maria. Thank you. Now, people may be wondering, wait a minute, Ave Maria, this doesn't sound like Ave Maria, but this is a different version of Ave Maria.
Right. It's, in this case, the Ave Maria is a prayer to the Madonna, as it were. This excerpt is from the last act. Desdemona says her prayers before she's going to bed, but she just has this feeling that something bad is about to happen, which it certainly does.
And what was that? What does happen to her?
Well, Otello finally has believed Iago's entreaties that Desdemona has been unfaithful to him. And then after she sings the Ave Maria, he comes into their bedroom and murders her and kills himself.
The things people will do for love.
Boy, ain't it the truth.
Okay, let's get to the next one you brought us. This is by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. This is Così fan tutte, which roughly translates to All Women Behave the Same. With a title like Così fan tutte, is this about infidelity of women?
Well, it's two guys trying to trap them, actually. These two guys have made a bet with a buddy that those girls won't stay true to them once they're gone. So at this point in the opera, they've just launched their plan. They've announced, we're going to war. And the girls are sad, but you can sort of hear the guys' music. There's some scheming going on underneath.
Now, why would an Austrian like Mozart be composing an opera that's in Italian?
Well, because he did. I mean, he composed him in German. He composed him in Italian. Mm-hmm. Kind of a certain style went with a certain language, and he composed old-fashioned Italian opera, opera seria, and more comic opera buffa, and etc.
Well, and it's such a beautiful language. What do you think, as you listen to different operas in different languages, what do you think is the most beautiful?
Oh, my gosh, that's a good question. Probably Italian, because mm-hmm. there are more in Italian and it just rolls off the tongue. People say Italian is so easy to sing, and so maybe I'd go with that one. But mm-hmm. I like German operas and I like French operas too, so I wouldn't want to pick a favorite, actually.
Okay, well, the next one you brought us is a French opera. This is by Georges Bizet. This, I'm not going to say it in French, but it is The Pearl Fishers. Here it is.
So beautiful. Mm-hmm. Well, this is Bizet's opera that's not Carmen, obviously. The story here is a young man and his best friend were once in love with the same woman, and they swore they'd both stay away from her. But now she's back in town. He's just heard her voice again, and all those feelings and memories are flooding back to him. Such stylish singing from Matthew Polanzani.
And this would be from, what, the 1800s, this opera?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. About 1860s.
And who would be going to the opera back in those days? Is this something that would be for just the elites, or is it the masses?
Oh, not at all. This was premiered in Paris at the Théâtre Lyrique, and that was like the people's opera house, where there was all sorts of different entertainment going on.
Okay, well, last but not least, we have a German opera. This is Das Rheingold by Richard Wagner. Now, the part that you wanted us to play has no lyrics in it. Why?
Well, opera is full of wonderful orchestral excerpts, maybe none more so than Wagner's four-opera epic, The Ring Cycle, Der Ring des Nibelungen. And since we're doing it at the Met this spring, I've just been hearing these things lately, and it's just in my ear, and it's just so magnificent to sit in the opera house and hear our great orchestra play these. There's several of them through it, and they all just take my breath away every single time.
That is Mary Jo Heath, the host and announcer for the Metropolitan Opera. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeremy. This was fun.
It's been almost 5 months since the campfire in Northern California. 86 people died. Nearly 14,000 homes were destroyed. Much of the destruction in the town of Paradise, where life is still far from normal. And just up the road from Paradise, in Magalia, things aren't much different. But some routines in Magalia are falling back into place, like kids going to school. Here now is Ashley Bailey, recently met up with an artist who's helping kids remember the beauty of where they live.
It's a crisp, gray morning in Magalia, and the school day has just begun.
Another day a little bit above Paradise. That's what they call Magalia, is a little bit above Paradise.
That's artist Jessie Mercer. Today, she's at Pine Ridge School, painting a detachable mural with some 7th graders.
I love it!
This is one of 11 schools where Jessie is painting murals with kids as part of her Butte County Art on Wheels program. She's also known for collecting house keys from campfire survivors that will be used to create a memorial sculpture for Paradise once it's rebuilt.
Now, what is one of the best things about paint if you mess up?
You can paint
it. You can paint right over it! Do you know how many times we painted the sky at Paradise? We painted it green, and then we were like, I've never seen a green sky. So we repainted it blue.
Jessie lost her art studio in the campfire. Her dad also lost his house. The kids at Pine Ridge can relate. About 70% of the students also lost their homes. And after the fire, half of the students had to relocate.
Ah, the paintbrush is too small.
Gracie, can I see?
12-year-old Alina Ringel is painting a blue sky above a mountain. Her house burned down, and she and her mom, stepdad, and 7-year-old brother have been living in a trailer inside her stepdad's shop.
We're on our property still, but everything's gone, so it's kind of sad. My stepdad works on cars, so it's kind of like tough because you have all the tools and then you have all your living stuff, and if you rub up against something, you can get everything all dirty because it's covered in grease.
Alina says it can be annoying to be in such tight quarters with everyone. Sometimes she reads to escape. She used to do more painting at her art desk at home. She's happy to be doing that again with the mural, creating something that will last a long time. 12-year-old Judah Meekum's home burned down, too. He's staying in Magalia now with his grandparents so he can be close to Pine Ridge.
So we have 6 people there and, like, 7 dogs. It's not ideal, but it works.
Judah says he initially had to stay over an hour away in Yuba City and go to school online.
It's awful. You don't learn anything. You just answer questions that they give you, and it's awful. But, yeah, this is fun.
Fun is clearly part of Jessie Mercer's mission as an artist. She's not just giving these kids paintbrushes. She wants to engage with them.
I need people to talk back to me, right? If I'm talking to you, it helps me because we need to communicate. So if something's going to help a little better, then let's do it. So, paintbrushes,
for a while, Jessie says she was buying the materials for the murals with her own money. But recently, she won a $15,000 grant for the project. Funding is never far from Talene Tomzarian's mind. This is her first year as Pine Ridge School principal. She, too, lost her home in the campfire. And now she's living in a rental. She's thankful for the support for the arts, but realizes the help that the school has been getting is just temporary.
So right now we have an abundance of resources. We're okay, but no, we're lacking resources to keep going. Because this is great, Jessie's here, but you know, I can't fund someone like Jessie to come here. That's what we need. We need continual support.
That'd be so, we should do for on top. We should like splatter the paint on top.
The students use orange, yellow, and pink to add a sunset behind the mountains. I asked Judah what kind of support he needs. He doesn't say much.
Because you don't know it, but then it's gone. Just be more thankful, accept what you have, and just be grateful for what you have.
At the end of the class, I get in Jesse's car. It doesn't take long to get hit with a cruel dose of reality.
There's a car flipped over. I see black, I see brown, I see some daffodils. But I see nothing but destruction in a standstill. And it's been 4 months, so it's really hard to have to continuously drive through hell.
It's a scene the kids at Pine Ridge view on their way to school each day.
And I think that's what you saw today with the kids, is me just constantly saying, you're worth it. I'm glad you're here. I think you're amazing. You're not alone. Is I just keep trying to tell these kids over and over and over again in motivational speeches, during the paintings, whatever it is. Like, I'm so proud of them because I can't imagine going through this as a youngster. I'm 33 years old. I can't even comprehend what they're doing.
For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Bailey.
And Ashley reported this story while volunteering at the public radio station North State Public Radio in Chico, California, part of her home region. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.